We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I'm Terry Foy, once again joined by Quint Kasnick. And Quint, we are recording this on Monday morning because we both had very busy weekends that included a tremendous Sunday of college lacrosse that we are going to dive right into. But first things first, how you doing? How you holding up?
Doing well. 20 games were played this weekend, many on Sunday. I had a wrestling match on Sunday night on ESPNU, Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, Bedlam. So it was a little reprieve from lacrosse. I'll do a lot of catching up this week has got Robert Morris in Notre Dame, hopefully indoors in the Thunderdome of Loftus on Saturday.
We will begin indoors where the Army Black Knights went into the Carrier Dome and fell behind 6-1 in the first quarter, aided by Tucker Dordovic's white-hot start to the game. He had three consecutive goals. He finished with four in the day. However, from that point, it was all Army as they scored 17 of the game's next 22 goals en route to taking home an 18-11 victory over the Orange. Army is now 1-1 with a win over Syracuse and a loss to Virginia. Syracuse starts their season 0-1. One more note on Dordovic is that he appeared to sustain a leg injury in the second half, walked off under his own power, was getting stretched out, but to my knowledge did not return to the game. For the Black Knights, once again, attackman Brennan Nichtern was spectacular. 4 goals and 3 assists. Bobby Abshire, 4 goals and 2 assists, really showing good chemistry on the finishing end of Nichtern's interior feeds. And I thought that that was the big story of the day for Army's offense versus the Orange defense. Coming into the game, maybe there was some attention paid to who was going to guard Nichtern with Nick Mellon no longer in a Syracuse uniform, but I really think it was that Orange interior defense and their inability to match feet and prevent getting cut by the Black Knight offense that told the story of this game.
Big picture item here, you know, Army playing game two, Syracuse debuting, and that's something we're seeing consistent across the landscape. You got some teams who are in their seasons. Duke played 4 games. Notre Dame hasn't played a single game. Okay, everybody's dealing with the virus, but everybody's calendar looks different, and that's why these games are really unpredictable. What kind of fall did you have? How was your preseason impacted? And Army of all places, West Point is a functioning bubble. I saw it during college football season. This pandemic has had little impact on the way they operate. And if you think about the student athlete at Army, their mental toughness, their physical toughness, that's a team that's built for this season. What I saw mainly from Syracuse was their defense's inability to guard 2-man games and a poor coverage of cutters and then poor fundamentals on their crease defense in terms of switching, in terms of being on the ball side shoulder of a man, in terms of having your stick up in a check position. Their interior defense on feeds to the inside was really bad. There were some simple fundamentals that they can clean up, and I'm sure they're going to go back to work. It also brings up a point. You know, Syracuse doesn't have a ball-handling attackman behind the net, so to speak. Most of their offense is run from the top down. So they don't see this type of look in practice. It's hard for them to, you know, put the ball behind the goal for those defensive players to get quality reps against their scout team to see what it's going to be like when Nichtern is feeding Abshire inside. And so Army scored at a really high percentage. Their shooting percentage was off the charts. And I was impressed with not only the Nichtern-Abshire connection, but Burns and Phillip and Jones. You had a bunch of different guys step up, and Army's going to be a dangerous team. Last thing I'll say, Terry, I thought it was a big weekend for the Patriot League.
Yeah, I agree, and we'll get to a couple of the other Patriot League games over the course of this podcast. A couple more points on Army, particularly because one of the things that folks will note coming away from reading your top 20 is you're really high on the Black Knights in terms of their potential going forward this season. One of the elements of their game over the course of the last couple years has been they've basically had to overcome a face-off deficiency, including in this game against Syracuse. I think it's notable that Stevie Graber won 13-25. So while the team overall only won 13 of 32, the fact that they had a guy on their team that was better than 50% was an important takeaway, I think, for Army in terms of their season-long outlook.
I thought they looked better than Ohio State. I thought they looked – there's no way you can rank Syracuse ahead of them. And they'll be I don't know what term I should use, but there'll be people who actually rank Syracuse ahead of Army this week. And that, more than anything, as an ex-athlete, just bugs me to no end. Because with the limited data points, you cannot rank a team that just defeated the other team on their home soil behind them. Okay, a couple weeks from now, you can flip-flop it, yes. But you can't do that right now.
I agree, and I ranked Army ahead of Syracuse. The Black Knights host St. Joseph's in their first home game this weekend, and then head to Boston University as they get Patriot League play underway. Let's move on Sunday to one of the more shocking final scores I can recall having seen in a really, really long time. Georgetown 16, Villanova 1. The Big East got underway this weekend. Georgetown went to Villanova Stadium. They went to the main line. And, I mean, the game was 1-1. And then all of a sudden it was not. And for me, I was splitting my attention between this and Syracuse Army in the first half, and then this and Richmond, North Carolina in the second half. So I'm not going to protest to know everything about what happened, but it seemed like every time I looked, Georgetown was canning a wide open time and room 10 to 12 yard shot. Whether it was Jake Caraway, who had 8 goals and an assist, firmly establishing himself in the Towerton conversation, or a litany of other Hoyas who ended up scoring, there was just no answer for all of the time and room shooting. And I just felt like you made the argument that this was a defensive performance. There's no question about it, right? You hold the team to one goal, it's eye-popping. But clearly, Georgetown could have won this game 16-15, and we would have been talking about their performance at the offensive end of the field. When you were describing the defensive end, you talked about how it felt like Georgetown's physicality beat the will out of Villanova, and I kind of got that sense at the offensive end as well.
Yeah, you know, holding a team to one goal in a shot clock era is, a high quality, potential top 20 team is it's off the charts. Swamp Dogs are going to play defense. We know that from Kevin Warren. This game reminds me, Terry, a little of when BYU played Navy to open the college football season. Okay, BYU is Georgetown. They're going to be good. They rolled Navy that day. Navy got better. Obviously, there's some pandemic issues, perhaps, in Nova's preparation for this game. Nova had lost some guys to graduation and transfer. So I'm bullish on Georgetown coming off this effort. You know, we talked last week. You go back to 2020, we had Syracuse, North Carolina, and Georgetown all undefeated when the season ended in 2020. And you look back in hindsight and you say, well, who did they really beat? You know, how good were they? And so I think everybody was on the bandwagon, and we saw what happened to Syracuse. Carolina has come back stronger, and apparently Georgetown has come back stronger as well. That's going to be a good defense. Swamp Dogs, they got a bunch of guys, Gibson Smith, Gibby's awesome on the ground. They got a tough guy mentality, and I don't think any team in the country teaches sliding when to go, when not to go, the timing of double teams. Georgetown rarely makes bad slides to create offense for your opponent, and they do a good job of fake sliding as well. So that Kevin Warren teaches that part of defense as good as anybody in the country. If you're a young coach or player, you get to watch any Georgetown tape. Just look for that on their defense. They follow their rules to a T and really do a good job of working together as six.
You mentioned North Carolina. They emerged victorious 14-9 over Richmond. The Spiders fall to 0-2 with an overtime loss to Loyola last week. And then this game that was close early, but the Tar Heels pulled away late. An important note is that the Spiders were playing without head coach Dan Shamati due to COVID safety protocols. North Carolina got goals from 10 different players, including 3 from Brian Cameron. And the Spiders were led by 2-2 from Ryan Lanchberry, 3-1 from Dalton Young, and 3 goals from Richie Connell. North Carolina also emerged victors over High Point at midweek in one of the more fun games that I've seen so far this season.
Yeah, that game was awesome. In my column, I wrote about it. Games like that just give me so much juice and give me so much joy. And I think that the highlights from that game, exist and populate on social media and do the sport great favors. But in that game, I thought North Carolina's defense was exposed. I thought Evan Egan played well. I thought Will Bowen played well. I thought Their shorty, Amar, 31, was outstanding. The rest of the guys needed to show me something, and they improved. You know, Joe Bresci went back to work defensively, and holding Richmond to single digits is a good showing. And Richmond's 0-2. I think they're top 20 quality team. I'm not sure you can have them in the top 20 right now, but they're, you know, with losses to they got two good losses right now, Carolina, and then week one they lost to Loyola close, both low scoring. So they got to find an offense. But Carolina, I think the biggest plus is there. As you said, depth of scoring continues to be a main storyline. Chris Gray only had 2 points, but we saw, Will Nicholas get some runs, and Henry Schertzinger scored a goal. And so, gosh, there's just waves of players that Coach Metzbauer can throw out there. Brian Cameron had the hat trick, and we also saw Cole Herbert have 2 assists. So depth of contribution, a Titan defense, a good sign for Carolina.
Moving to Saturday, the big story, Rutgers 11, Penn State 9. Of course, the Nittany Lions, one of the best teams in college across the last 2 years, head to Piscataway and come home with a loss. The question coming into the season for Penn State was, what does this offense look like without Grant Dement? And particularly, what does Mac O'Keefe look like as he was held to one goal? The answers are still TBD, in my opinion. Whereas for Rutgers, the infusion of the Kursts proved to be very meaningful in the outcome of this game. Connor Kurst, one of the best-known quantities in college lacrosse over the last several years, a first-team All-American midfielder, played attack in this game and produced 7 points. But his brother, who had been waiting patiently to make his contribution in net, Colin Kurst, made 15 saves in a meaningful factor in the outcome of this game.
Yeah, you know, U.S. Lacrosse had a great article on this game. Connor Kurst transferring from Nova, his brother transferring from Lehigh, national anthem at the school their dad played at, you know, near tears pregame, and then for them to deliver the way they did in their opener, there's some magic there. Connor looked like a man. I mean, he's a big boy, and he was rumbling to the middle of the field. Sherilyn Beattie's now in his, what, sixth or seventh year, produced at clutch time. When you turn to Penn State, you know, they lost a goaltending battle, clearly. Their lack of depth of scoring. I mean, they only had 4 guys who had a point. Mac O'Keefe shot 1 of 7. It was Folds, Reum, and Malone. And then after that, like, who did what? I think both teams will move forward off this game. I think this is a flair. People had been talking about Rutgers being improved. Yeah, they're improved. They're a legitimate contender in the Big Ten. And Penn State still has work to do. So I'm not rushing. I'm not looking at the result, the win or the loss. But I'm telling you that both teams seem like they're definitely top 12, if not better.
Yeah, I think for Penn State fans, you're going to want to keep an eye on guys like Cole Willard, Jack Kelly, who was held scoreless, a surprising outcome for sure. Jack Traynor, who has shown a ton of potential, is another guy to keep an eye on in terms of contributions going forward. And then the Utah transfer, Matt Costin. So we know that there's talent, there's proven production among guys who didn't produce on Saturday. And the question is, how are they going to get there over the course of the remainder of the season? Yeah. It does not get easier as Penn State hosts Maryland on Friday.
No, that's a good point, Terry, because you improve most after your first game. You improve a great deal after your first loss. Well, those are combined in this situation, facing a Maryland team who just trucked Michigan. So if you're Penn State, you could lose to Maryland and still very much be in the hunt, but you got to show improvement. Regardless of results, you know, you always want to show continual improvement, especially early in the year.
Staying in the Big Ten, Ohio State headed to Homewood Field and captured a 14-8 victory over Johns Hopkins. It was a game that was more lopsided than that. At one point, the Buckeyes were leading 9-2, I believe shortly before halftime. And I came home with a different reaction from you in terms of what it meant for Ohio State. Not because, which is to say, you weren't overly high on Ohio State, and I understand why, but the point that I was making is, so it was 9-2 late in the second quarter. Hopkins then cut it to 10-6. It was clear that Coach Peter Milliman was happy with his team's resiliency and ability to battle back. At that point, the game should have been out of contention, right? When Hopkins cut it to 10-6, Ohio State should probably already have had 13 or 14 goals. It felt like they took their foot off the gas a little bit offensively. And in that moment, I said to myself, I was like, Ohio State plays the game to win by one goal. They don't play to score on every single possession or score as many goals in a game as they possibly
can. That's exactly right.
The way other teams...
Like a football team with a... That's exactly right. Like a football team going into a huddle when they're up 17 points and maybe winning by 7 or 10 instead of stretching it to a 24 or 31 point margin. That's exactly right.
And so the reason I was so impressed by what they were able to do is because it had very little to do with the offensive end. I thought that they were productive. I thought that they played well. But I attribute a lot of that to bad defense out of Johns Hopkins, particularly early. The number of times Ohio State Dodgers were able to get to the middle of the field and score unassisted goals with no resistance, no slide that came either because the slider was out of position, didn't go, or didn't know that he was supposed to go. I counted three or four instances when they were building their initial 6-1 lead where that happened. And at the other end of the field, though, I thought Ohio State played with so much energy and so much physicality, and they did a really nice job coordinating between their man, a zone, and a five-man zone, and really frustrated Hopkins into settling for mid-range shots, particularly early, and that allowed goalie Skylar Wallen to settle in. I should mention this was the first game that I attended since March 9th of 2020, which was a very cool experience, but also very weird in many respects, particularly the absence of the Johns Hopkins band, but allowed for...
I didn't know you were there, Terry.
I'm sorry?
I didn't know you were there. What was it like?
Yeah. It was cold. It was very cold, even in the press box. It was. I don't know how many more games I'm going to go to this year because, and I had an expectation going in that the primary benefit to go into these games is the casual conversations that you have with coaches and players, particularly pregame, but then a little bit postgame. Well, we're not allowed to do any of that. So it's really just sitting in the press box where the primary advantage is you can look at what you want to look at. So, for example, when Kyle DiPietro collided with Omari DeBerry, it was inadvertent. They were kind of in substitution and whatever. Both guys went down. DiPietro looked like a serious injury. And the fact that he was able to walk off the field and then I was able to look down on the bench and see that he had an ice pack wrapped around his quad and it looked like they were treating a Charlie horse more than a torn ACL or anything like that. That's a benefit of going. I'm not certain that you can, I mean, sometimes the broadcast shows that and sometimes they don't. I think to the point I was getting at in terms of, I was just so impressed by I was glad that I was there because of my ability to focus on Ohio State's defense, particularly the way the guys were moving off ball. It was so frenetic that it almost seemed random. And it was something that I felt like I didn't really have a sense for to the extent that I had seen it before. So I was glad that I was able to like leave with that observation. But my point is that like I think Ohio State's defense is going to be good going forward. I'm really excited to see the test that they're going to have when they do end up playing Maryland. And I think that when they play Rutgers, you know, that offers a different challenge. So I think that it's going to be fascinating to just kind of monitor that. Given that they host the Scarlet Knights next week. But the last thing I'll say about the benefit of being there in person was you get a sense for the physicality, the physical attributes of a player in a way that is hard to come through on the broadcast, right? And this is something that we've known for a really long time. So I have a couple of impressions of particularly who's really big or who's really small that I'll carry with me. I think Eric Wenz, the Ohio State defenseman, a transfer from Hofstra, huge addition, not just in terms of his impact, but in terms of his size. He is a huge player. Brendan Grimes is enormous. Some of these guys, Griffin Hughes in particular, Connor Delaney, the long stick for Johns Hopkins, those two came across as really small. So you get those impressions both ways. But aside from that, I'm not sure that it was worth it. So point being, I don't know how many more games I'm going to go to this season.
Interesting. Yeah, I find this game to be very complex to analyze because both teams had very irregular preseason up to it. Okay, Johns Hopkins had no fall. They had, you know, captain's practices. They had a shutdown for a week. So they were ill prepared to play anywhere near their capabilities. So in that regard, it looked like a first scrimmage, and I write about that in my poll. I mean, the sloppiness of their exchanges, their inability to handle the ball, just really simple things. And then you add the next layer, the nuance would be, you know, a zone offense because Ohio State threw the kitchen sink at them. Well, Ohio State wanted to win this game, and Ohio State themselves were dealing with COVID issues. You know, no faceoff man. They've had major personnel outages and guys being unavailable for their training camp to where they couldn't do riding or clearing. So, you know, with that, with an eye in that regard, it is impressive what Ohio State did. But I would temper Buckeye fans over this win because Hopkins was pretty bad. Like, you know, that wasn't good at all. And so, like, pump the brakes a little. And if you're a Hopkins fan, you know, take the positives and know that this team can improve a great deal in the next coming weeks. So I think both, the jury's still out, really. I think we'll look back at this game in a month and say, okay, I'm just not sure right now I can glean everything I need to glean from it because I think there's so many kind of moving parts around it. I didn't think Ohio State's offense was that great, quite honestly. I don't know. It just watching it, you know, Ryan Tarafenko was the guy who jumped out at me. He played an amazing game. I thought LeClaire had four. I thought he could have had six or eight, quite honestly. I thought he missed some layups. I thought Ohio State's shooting in the second half was really not good at all. You know, Kirsten has some knowledge there, which paid off. And then you turn to Hopkins. You know, Joey Epstein is back to 100%. He's got to make more of an impact. I mean, he's a very good player, but sometimes I think people went a little overboard in the success he had as a freshman. Because if you go back to that year, was it 2019?
Yep.
The Big Ten had no defense. Maryland had no team in the Big Ten was playing defense in 2019 when he finished that season with such a flourish, hitting all those severe angle shots. And I'm a little more inclined, again, to pumping the brakes in terms of his dominance. You know, he's not the type of attackman who's going to post his guy up and wow you. You know, he's going to get points within the flow of the game. He's a very good player, no doubt. So, again, I could go back and forth here. This game, I'm a little sketchy, quite honestly. What I saw, what it really means, given the lack of seasoning from both teams. So, yeah, I think if you're Ohio State, pat yourself on the back. You had a road win week one. You dealt with some circumstances. You got to improve. If you're Johns Hopkins, it's clear you got to get better. That's easy to see.
Yeah, in terms of some kind of positives that you could take away if you're Hopkins, I will say I didn't notice the sloppiness in person to the extent that I did watching the re-air on Sunday morning. I thought that Josh Kirsten, he made 13 stops. He let in 14. But that it was a better day than a sub 50% day, in my opinion.
Yes. So I think that, you know, he was good. He's an upgrade. Grimes will be an upgrade. You know, I'm trying to think of who else. You know,
So Matt Naruski was a surprise.
Apparently, didn't play.
Matt Naruski was a surprise start at the Faceoff X over Kyle Prouty. You mentioned Naruski, that he was going against not faceoff guys, so very difficult to analyze. But at the same time, still looked competitive in the 50-50 ground balls that you expect to be more prevalent. So is he going to be dominant? Yeah. No.
There are upgrades. But Terry, at the end of the day, if you can't cover a guy in space as a midfielder, like, it doesn't matter. Like, what they're going to have to play zone defense because they don't have poles and shorties who can cover quality players in the Big Ten, period. They got run around like they were, you know, white traffic cones out on University Parkway. So, you know, I don't like, we can say all we want about their close defense, but if you got holes, just blatant holes and leakage that compromises everybody else, you know, that's problem number one. And I'm not sure they can play man-to-man defense in that league with that personnel.
The element of the game that we the bright spot for Hopkins that we did not mention, Connor DeSimone makes the move from midfield to X attack, and I thought played pretty well. He was their most productive player. He had scored two goals early in the game that kind of felt like, and Milliman said this post-game, he was putting the team on his shoulders. I agree with you in terms of both Epstein and Grimes need to make a greater impact. In talking with Milliman, he referenced more the mistakes, basically the need to cut down on their mistakes. But I think for Epstein, it's a question of learning how to make an impact on that portion of the field. And I felt like a zone defense was such a great decision for Ohio State to play because I think Hopkins is going to score a lot of one-pass goals. I just think that's what their personnel is designed to do. They have guys who are going to want to dodge, draw a slide, feed the slider, you know, feed the guy who kind of beat the second slide and score that way, or throw skips. And I think that the zone very much took that away. And like I said, I think that's why they settled for these mid-range shots. So I think that you're right in the sense that the time to develop scheme, to develop familiarity, to learn what are the principles and priorities of this coaching staff are going to be necessary. But I also agree with you that there are physical limitations, particularly in terms of their ability to match feet in their fourth, fifth, sixth positions on the defensive end of the field. And it might be the type of thing that they're not able to overcome this year.
Yeah, only so many hours in the day for John Grant Jr., the offensive coordinator. You know, he's still trying to learn personnel. What kind of scheme are they going to play with on offense, let alone Ohio State throws a zone at you? You know, usually zone offense has been a strength of the Blue Jays in the last 5 years under Bob Benson. This is a different group, a different coaching staff, a different time frame on the calendar in terms of practice hours. So zoning Hopkins in the last 3 years was like the stupidest thing you could do. You want to get out and play him and make an athletic game. But for this game, in week one, it was an extremely effective strategy.
Let's move on. I went to two games on Saturday. I was in attendance at Loyola for Virginia's 15-12 victory over the Greyhounds. You mentioned that this was a good weekend for the Patriot League, in addition to Navy's win over Mount St. Mary's, Boston University's win over Merrimack, and then, as we discussed, Army's win over Syracuse. Loyola put in a really nice showing, and I think the thing that was most impressive about their game versus Virginia is that, so first and foremost, they immediately jumped ahead 4-1, which I think answered a lot of questions as to were the deficiencies that we saw against the offense on against Richmond, are they just kind of the hallmark of this team? And they showed pretty clearly that the answer was no. They carried over the momentum that they built in the last 10 minutes of that come-from-behind victory over the Spiders. But then what was even more impressive than that was on two occasions they fell behind by two goals, and one they fell behind by three goals, and in all three instances were able to claw back and tie the game. They had an opportunity down 13-12 to tie it once again with about 6 minutes to go. They came up short, and then Virginia added two goals late in order to build the three-goal cushion and make sure that the game was not in doubt in the final minutes. But ultimately, I think that resilience is something that Loyola is going to be able to build on. Charlie Toomey was quick post-game to mention that there are no moral victories for that program, but at the same time, Kevin Lindley scoring both his traditional inside goals, his wing shooting goals, but then adding the element of just being able to beat a guy one-on-one and score. You know, he had really timely emotional goals, and I think Evan James' insertion into the starting lineup at attack due to an injury to Joey Kamish was revelatory as well. So there are pieces there for Loyola, but ultimately the story of this game is Virginia's offense and just how, in some instances, they're unguardable. Matt Moore had five goals. Peyton Cormier had three goals. Connor Schellenberger had a, quote, quiet 2-3, in my opinion. He scored once on a deflected goal, and he definitely made a bigger impact on feeding or via feeding than he did by his goal scoring. It was really, for me, just Moore and Cormier. Those guys can, it seems like, get one whenever they need one.
This game validates Loyola in my eyes. You know, too often we associate winning and losing with moving up and down in the polls. This is a loss where I actually probably wanted to bump Loyola up because of this game, them showing the ability that they could score against an athletic team like Virginia. Loyola, I still think, needs to develop more depth, more weapons, more guys who can come in and contribute. Lindley's going to be their star. And then for Virginia, a little concern. They only had three assists. You know, this has been typically a good passing team, especially in transition. Loyola handled the 10-man for the most part. And you know, that's critical when you're playing Virginia, because you play them in a half-field game, it gives you a shot. Matt Moore took 14 shots. I mean, that is just a boatload of shots. And again, I still think Virginia's got more there offensively, depth-wise. You know, you mentioned the stars. Bertrand continues to play well. They're not getting much out of that next midfield, so to speak. And when the 10-man doesn't work, they got to find ways to run in transition. So first road trip for the Cavs, they took three buses up. That's never easy this year. Okay, this year the road trips are going to be tough, especially when it's cold out and you got locker room issues. You're dressing outside, and so this was a big step for Virginia, and I thought it was revealing about how good Loyola could be. So I moved both teams forward off of this game.
Virginia heads to Syracuse on Saturday night, one of the best games of the calendar every year. Fortunately, this year we know we're going to get it twice, as the Orange will return to Charlottesville in April. Loyola hosts Utah, who's coming off of an overtime loss to Air Force. It's going to be a great weekend of college lacrosse. Quint, you mentioned you're getting an opportunity to see Notre Dame make their debut.
Yeah, that'll be interesting because they've really spotted many teams in their conference a head start. And so this is either going to be we never caught up, or we're fresh in April and May and peaking when other teams may have peaked earlier, or maybe they avoid some COVID issues. So they're going to host Robert Morris on Saturday. You can watch that game on the ACC network. We've also got Syracuse hosting Virginia on the ACC network on Saturday. Friday night's a great one. Penn State and Maryland. Joe Beninati and Mark Dixon will be on site at State College. That's 5:30 Friday night on BTN. Maryland, Penn State, that should be. So those are really three quality games this weekend on television. And I will throw out this, Terry. I think, you know, a little pet peeve as I'm watching tape this morning. Some of these game feeds, we as a group, as a lacrosse broadcasting community, whether you're working for a school or working for a network, we got to do better. I'm trying to watch this Maryland game, and it's like shot from the blimp. I can't even see numbers. It's like little specks. You know, there are other feeds that really need to be upgraded. So let's focus. I know this year's tough with the pandemic and everyone's availability, but you know, as a group, I'd love to see our feeds improve to serve the fan right now who's really stuck at home and trying to watch as much lacrosse as they can.
Well, I don't want to double down on a negative note to end this, but there is one more element of the lacrosse week that we need to get to, which was on Thursday, the Ivy League announcing that there will be no competition this spring among Ivy League teams, meaning that there will be no regular season standings or champion or Ivy League tournament or AQ to the NCAA tournament. However, and to me, this was the most newsworthy part, meaning that everything that I just said, I'd already expected on the basis of the decisions that Yale and then subsequently Cornell had made. But what was surprising about Thursday's news is that the league said that if in their local markets, the phasing, which is what they refer to as, you know, moving from phase one to phase two to phase three, and then ultimately phase four is what allows for game competition, and it's all based on the local indicators of COVID prevalence in your area. If a team were to get to phase four, they would be allowed to play local competition. So, for example, Penn, who has they have 45 guys on campus, if they started practicing, we've seen video of that on their social media, would be allowed to play, for example, Villanova, St. Joe's, Drexel, etc. We've heard that five games are required in order to receive consideration for at-large bid to the NCAA tournament. And with particularly the programs that have practiced, such as Brown, Penn, and Dartmouth, I think has practiced as well, it'll be fascinating to me to see whether or not they choose to play games. And it's something to keep an eye on for sure as this moves forward.
Yeah. Yeah. If I were you and Matt, and maybe even me, we should be reaching out to these coaches and to find out now that they've had a week, a half a week to digest. They know what their current situation on campus is. Have they reached out to opponents? Like, is this even a possibility? I know I talked to Andy Shea last week. He had practice for two student athletes on campus. Jerry Byrne is doing small, I think his freshman class, he's got nine or so guys. So he's doing some small group teaching and small practices. I'm not sure what's going on at Cornell with many of their student athletes taking the semester off. So this is
I've got a little insight on Cornell. They have enough players on campus that they could field a roster that would play games. However, they've made the decision that they will not. They will not be playing games this year. And so we can cross them off the list.
Yeah. Again, so this is a story that's evolving, and I think it more involves Penn more than anyone else because of their current situation with everyone's in school on campus, and they are regionalized where they could play easily. five games.
Yep. Yeah, it'll be fascinating to watch. And I would add Brown to that list as well. I don't know for certain that they have as many guys on campus. I do know that they have most, if not potentially all of their players. And I do know that they were starting to get practice as well. So Dartmouth does not. They have at least one class year that is not on campus. But Penn, Brown, and Dartmouth are the three that are worth watching as far as what they decide to do going forward. So we will continue to report on this. Make sure to check out InsideLacrosse.com. I know a lot of you already did this weekend. We had a really big weekend on the website, such that we actually had to do some upgrades because we had some minute-long outages on Saturday. So we rolled out our new full real-time stat updating feature on Thursday. It seemed to work as effectively as we had hoped. That's for all divisions, Division 1, 2, and 3, men's and women's. Anybody that's got a live stream, you're going to be able to visit InsideLacrosse.com scoreboard and see full real-time stats, every stat, goal assist, save, cause turnover, turnover, face-off win, anything that you could want, you'd be able to find on InsideLacrosse.com. We're really excited about it. Credit to Mike Gilbert and Patrick McEwen for all the work that they did in order to get that going. It is the first of multiple updates that will be rolling out, hopefully before the end of the season, if not surely in advance of the 2022 campaign. So it was a pandemic-affected year for InsideLacrosse.com, but we are starting to get our early games under our belt. And Quint, as always, appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us on the Quick Restart Podcast.
Thank you, Terry, and thank the fans for listening. Everybody stay safe and hang in there.
We'll be back next week with more Inside Lacrosse Podcasts.
We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.